Let's talk Red Sox as we welcome in our friend Sean McAdam of Mass Live. Hello there, Sean.
Hi, Rich. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How are you on this day before your vacation?
Yes, indeed. We're counting the hours until our party of 14 arrives in the great state of Maine. A little south of you, but we'll be full-time residents of vacation land for the next week.
Excellent. Well, I'll get in touch with my people down there and make sure they roll out the red carpet. Well, let's talk about the Red Sox here and what's going on, the final few before the All-Star break, and the team continues to play good baseball and win series. But as you pointed out in your recent piece at MassLive.com, the struggles versus left-handers are a real issue for this team.
Yeah, 12-14 now in games started by left-handers. That can be a little misleading at times. But, one look at that Red Sox roster, and it's easy to imagine why that issue might exist. It is a left-handed lineup with the best performers, for the most part, all hitting from the left side, whether you're talking about Devers or Duran or Abreu, or when he's healthy again, Tristan Casas. I mean, there's a lot of nights where there's usually only two right-handers in the lineup. Sometimes that's Connor Wong and Sidon Rafaela. And so they not only don't have a lot of right-handed hitters, but in something of an oddity, they haven't faced a lot of lefties lately, and that kind of showed last night. Pivetta had one bad inning where it kind of got away from him. He gave up three runs there in the third, and they could never catch up.
The Brian Bayo outing a couple of nights ago was in some ways a microcosm of what we've seen from him in his young career, but the first 10 outs of the game for him were strikeouts, but then giving up the big hit, not being able to get out of innings, and he's got one of the strangest lines you'll see, 9 wins, but an ERA of 5.40.
Yeah, he's been fortunate, as he was the other night, Rich, to get a lot of run support when he's out there, because you would not normally expect somebody to have that one loss record when you're giving up 5.5 runs per 9 innings. And you're right, that outing the other night sort of embodied everything that you both like and don't like about Bayo this year. He's obviously got great swing and miss stuff, as evidenced by the 10 strikeouts in a row and the 11 overall and just 5 1/3. But the fact that he needed 104 or 5 pitches to get 16 outs, the fact that he was hit hard when he was in the zone, those things definitely worry you. And to me, although talking to people after the game on Tuesday night, nobody seemed to be zeroing in on this. But the fact that they have repeatedly been asking him to be in the strike zone more, to trust his stuff, and it almost looked like he was overcompensating and being too down the middle. And when that happens, even his good stuff was being hit hard and producing, bad results for the Red Sox. So it's just one more reminder that he's not a finished product, that there's a lot to like there, but there are still some things for him and the team to overcome.
Nice start the other night, a good bounce back in the Yankee game by Cutter Crawford.
Yeah, he had kind of hit the wall about a month ago. He had done a lot in the offseason to get stronger, with the aim to go deeper in games. That was an issue last year. He'd get up to 75 or 80 pitches last year, and he'd kind of hit a wall. And the velo would start to drop. He wouldn't have the good action on some of his breaking pitches. So he put a lot of work in the offseason to strengthening his lower half, trying to become more durable. And then, about 2+ months in, it seemed like he had, as I said, kind of hit a wall. And they gave him a little extra time between starts, moved some things around. And it seems like he's kind of gotten a second wind here, because that night against the Yankees, he was not only dominant but highly efficient to go, what was it, 68 pitches, I think, to get through six or so innings. You'd love to see that every 5 days, and it's another example of another Red Sox starter, and Tanner Houck certainly heads this list of guys who have taken big steps forward under Andrew Bailey and the new pitching program this season.
And how important is that, Sean, as we get into the second half of the season, the post-All-Star break stretch, to have those starters go out there and get a little bit of break for the bullpen, because they're going to be gassed by late August the way they're going?
Yeah, they're already in the top 10 in terms of innings pitched for the bullpen in Major League Baseball. And given that we have not really even hit the dog days yet, that typically comes, late July into August, that's something they have to be wary about, which I think is one of the reasons they seem to have identified deepening that starting rotation as a real priority should they indeed decide to buy at the deadline. They would like to be able to get some additional starters, maybe get a veteran guy who's been through the wars a little bit. So many of these guys, like Crawford, like Houck, they may have a few years of big league service time, but they haven't really been in a playoff race before, and you're not sure how they're going to react to that, both mentally and physically. So, they've got Cooper Criswell, who could well be summoned to pitch tomorrow. And I think you're going to have them looking to add some other arms there if they can for the final couple of months in the stretch run.
We're talking with Sean McAdam here on Downtown, and you talked with him, you wrote about it. Craig Breslow says the team is going to pick a lane. We're not going to see what we've seen the last year of sort of trying to thread that needle and be sort of a buyer, maybe a seller, a little of each, but it ended up being neither one and nothing successful. So how crucial are these first, week and a half of games post-All-Star break?
Yeah, huge. And there are going to be some challenges there, too. You've got three against the Dodgers. Certainly one of the handful of best teams in the game coming out of the break. Three against the Rockies makes it a little easier. And then it's back home and you've got the Yankees in town. And while we know the Yankees have struggled mightily for the last month, anytime you've got Juan Soto and Aaron Judge coming into Fenway, you have your hands full. So, after that, they've got Seattle and some other teams and Baltimore as they get closer to the deadline at the end of July. So they're going to have to keep playing at a high level to convince ownership and the front office that they are worthy of that investment and that they want to, spend either money and or prospects to try to get better.
Now, what about a guy like Kenley Jansen? Do they have people they feel could close? Could they, even if they're buying, could they flip Jansen for something that would be of more value to them and slot someone else into the ninth inning?
Well, I think that would be possible, except for two factors. One, you had just got done recounting Craig Breslow saying that it's not workable to try to both buy and sell. So that would seem to guard against that kind of schizophrenic approach
right. That
they took a couple of years ago. And the other is, while I think there's the expectation that Liam Hendricks could contribute before the end of the year, he's not going to be ready by July 31st. He is right now only throwing fastballs in his bullpen session. He'll have to ramp that up to using all pitches, then throw live BP, and then eventually go out on a rehab assignment. Stands to reason there's just no way all that gets done in 3 weeks' time. So while Hendricks might be available in mid-August or even September 1st, not right away, you've had Chris Martin, who's closed some, not a whole lot in his big league career, but he's had a couple of elbow scares that have sidelined him, so you wonder about his durability. And then you've got guys who have the stuff and the swing and miss ability, like Slayton and some others. But again, you know, we're talking about a rookie who is a Rule 5 pick who doesn't have a lot of experience. Do you really want to be entrusting him and preserving a one-run lead down the stretch when he's never been in a safe situation before? So my guess is they hold on to Jansen, assuming that the team doesn't nosedive here and fall out of the wild card race, in which case, you know, Jansen would certainly be a guy they'd be looking to sell off.
We assume the big three in the minors are untouchable, and so who's the biggest prospect they might float out there in a deal?
Well, I think you have to think of a couple of guys who started the year in Portland and have since moved up to Worcester. Matthew Lugo, who was a former second-round pick and drafted as a shortstop but has been playing the outfield and can move around with some versatility and some pop. And another is a former first-round pick in Nick York, who was drafted as the second baseman, but he also has been moving around and playing some outfield. And he's got 6 home runs in just a few weeks up in Worcester. Both those guys would appear to be kind of blocked here long-term. Then again, Rich, if you go back to 21 and the Red Sox's last significant trade deadline acquisition, that was Kyle Schwarber. Do you remember who they gave up for him?
No, I don't, actually.
Well, that's kind of my point. It was a young pitcher named Aldo Ramirez.
Oh, wow.
Who was at single A at the time and then subsequently had Tommy John surgery and at last look, and I mean like last week, was still in single A in Washington's minor league system some 3 years later. So we tend to think of, you know, teams demanding prospects at the top of the organization, guys like Lugo and York, who no doubt have trade value. But oftentimes, you know, you hear about a trade at the deadline and it involves, you know, what people in baseball might call a lottery pick, a guy who was an international free agent, might not have even left the Dominican Summer League yet and hasn't made his stateside debut in pro ball, could be 18, 19 years old and on the move. And that was kind of Ramirez's profile, and he got them Kyle Schwarber, a guy who was in some demand at the time. So I think, as I said, we tend to expect that it's going to be a name that we know that might be blocked or doesn't have an easy path to the big leagues that they might give up, but it could also be somebody from way down in the lower rungs of the system that none of us have even heard of.
Speaking of the big three, what did Craig Breslow say about their short-term future?
Well, he was pretty cagey because I think everybody in the organization knows that there is a great deal of interest and excitement attached to all three of those. Anthony, Meyer, and Teal. Everyone wants to know when are they going to be making their big league debut, and they all know that that's not going to happen until they get some time at AAA. So that's the next obvious step. You know, he answered in kind of a generic way that, you know, the Red Sox want to make sure that all three of them are still being challenged where they are, that all three of them are taking the proper development steps. In short, he didn't answer the question or give any golden answer about how soon it might be. I'm expecting that at least one, if not two, I would expect Anthony would be the last guy to be moved. He's the youngest of the three, just turned 20 a couple of months ago. Meyer and Teal are both older. Teal obviously competed at a higher level, playing at University of Virginia in a good baseball conference in the ACC. So he's more advanced. I would think maybe he might be the first to go. And it wouldn't surprise me if that happened for Teal or maybe even Meyer in the next few weeks. But it doesn't seem imminent for any of them right now.
I thought it was some interesting comments that Alex Cora made recently when he was asked about the next steps for this team as they continue to surprise people and improve. And he talked about having a legitimate home field advantage again. And then I thought, he fired a little shot across the bow at Sam Kennedy when he said, yeah, we want people here to watch baseball, not to be here for the Fenway experience.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's how attendance has stayed relatively good. I mean, you know, even against the lowly Oakland A's the last couple of nights, they've had crowds of, you know, 30, 31,000 or so. You know, and this is for a team that only a few weeks ago was struggling, the Red Sox, struggling to get over 500. So there is that appeal where the Red Sox are always going to be, you know, 2.5 million fans because people like the game. They want to enjoy it. We've seen increasingly a lot of visiting fans making a Fenway trip part of their summer experience to see a historic ballpark like that. But there are nights, and it certainly happened when the Yankees and Phillies were in town last month, and you see it occasionally, where the ballpark really comes alive and is energized by the style of play that the Red Sox are playing. And that's really kind of the next step, as Cora hinted at the last couple of days. They've actually played very well on the road, but they continue to have a sub-500 mark at home. And that's kind of a weird thing when you think about how dominant traditionally good Red Sox teams have been at home.
Sean McAdam, Mass Live. Great talking with you. As always, Sean, have a wonderful time in Maine next week. Enjoy that vacation, and we'll catch you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good, Rich. Thanks.
You're welcome. Sean McAdam here on Downtown.